It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My new 15-minute story and opinion shows, John Mack's Radio Rants, may also be accessed by going to my website. Once again, www.johnmack13.com and clicking the John Mack Radio Rants tab for an index of the shows. Unlike this show, the new show has no regular schedule but is produced weekly. My guest next week on this show is poet, essayist, and educator Michelle Somerville. I hope you'll join us then.
East side, west side, all around the town, the tots and ring a rosy, London Bridge is falling down.
The lead-in tells us that my guest tonight, the environmental scientist slash professional photographer Kathleen Collins, is an Inwood native. That's my old neighborhood, in Upper Manhattan, in New York City. I first remember Kathy when she moved into the house next to mine on Seaman Avenue. She had lived in another part of what we saw at God's Country, and was not at all happy about being relocated, even though her new house had three classmates already living there. I knew from the start that Kathy was somewhat unusual when I saw her walking her cat on a leash. Over the years, we saw each other often on the street corners. We would stop and talk sometimes into the night, then later in the bar culture that we both grew into. We even shared some bizarre Cartwright's home from the Wall Street area with one particularly wild Inwoodite. I remember one such ride home requiring the immediate intake at the local bowling alley of more Manhattans than I've drank in my life while Kathy and I recovered from the journey. I've always found it to be intelligent, interesting, and a pleasure to talk with. And now you, my audience, will get to share this pleasure. So let's get started. Good evening, Kathy, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. Nice to be here.
Does my tale of that car ride ring a bell?
It does. The martini story rings more of a bell, I'm afraid, because the next morning I don't think I made the carpool. yeah, that was wild. That was wild.
Was I correct in remembering that first you didn't want to come and live next door to me?
I absolutely did not, no. Sorry. Nothing personal. No, I was from the other end of Inwood, down 204th Street, across from St. Jude's. And I was pulled kicking and screaming up to the wealthy side of the community. And I'm not sure I ever quite got used to it. I was always more comfy with the gritty end of things down on 2/4 and Post Avenue around there. But It was a nice apartment and met a lot of good people, including yourself. So there I stayed until.
You went to the local Catholic grammar school, Good Shepherd, and then to the local Catholic high school, Sacred Heart of Mary. A mutual friend of ours, Anne Marie Shay Abramson, told me just a few years ago that the teaching order there, the madams of the Sacred Heart of Mary, weren't very nice to you during your time there. She said that you were very bright and much too much independent for their liking. When I asked you about it, you said that her memory was accurate. Is that still your memory?
It was, yeah, that's accurate. It wasn't much fun. I mean, I had fun in high school. I had fun with the other girls, but the instructors were nightmarish. And my last word from them was the Reverend Mother calling me into her office as I was a graduating senior and telling me that, "We hope we never see anyone like you in this school again." And I said, "Likewise." And I left, and that was the end. That was the end of my SHM career.
And the school is long gone, so we'll never have an opportunity to do that. It's now the Seventh-day Adventist school.
That's right.
And then off to college. Is that a better experience?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. I mean, I waited a while before I went back to college, I went to college because I wanted to. So I went to City College, which was great. I was working at the same time, so it was sort of a commuting experience. But I got my degree in biology, and then I went straight into Columbia into graduate school.
What had you done in the interim between high school and college?
Got married and had a baby.
And then went back to college. Okay.
And then went back to college, yeah.
And how did you come to choose biology as a major?
Well, I had always been interested in science since I was a kid. My father had bought me a chemistry set, and I almost burned down the kitchen. And, you know, that was the thing that I had the most passion for. So it was sort of a no-brainer. When I went back in and had to choose a major, I said definitely life sciences and earth sciences as well.
Speaking
I minored in geology, so.
Oh, okay. Speaking of your father, you've told me that he exposed you to photography at a young age, and that also that your uncle had been an AP World War II photographer. Did you ever consider pursuing that as a career right out of high school?
No, I didn't. I mean, I just enjoyed making pictures, but I never really considered it as a career. And it's a hard career to get into and to make any money in. I suppose that's probably why I never seriously considered it. I mean, my uncle was lucky because he was with Associated Press. And he did some wonderful traveling. I still remember his pictures from North Africa and Germany after the war. And he had given my father some great Leicas that he brought home from Germany, and my father just lashed into it. He loved it as well. And he had given me a Brownie box camera when I was little, so that's what I started with, and just continued on from there. But it was always really a hobby until I had some free time to just really focus on what I wanted to do, and I did make a living out of it in fits and starts over my career. But I've been back and forth between doing that for money and doing it for the sheer enjoyment of it. And I'm in the latter phase at the moment. You know, fortunately, I do shows and I can sell images, but it certainly wouldn't be enough to pay the rent. So...
When you were choosing biology as the concentration, that must have been part of the early time if there was a, then of environmental science, had you planned to go on into environmental science?
Well, once I started in biology and got more into it, then I realized how much more there was to it, how many more aspects of study there were. And I think from day one, I've always had the feeling that the environment is kind of in a tricky place, and it's probably going to get worse. I remember being at the first Earth Day and feeling that in Central Park and feeling that I had finally met up with kindred spirits, that, you know, this was not all in my head, that there were problems out there, and that if people didn't take steps to make some corrections, that the environment was simply going to be unsustainable. So that was kind of when I was in school as well. So it all sort of hooked together.
Speaking of that time, during our college years and somewhat thereafter, we were both part of the Inuit drinking culture. Upon reflection, there was much good in it, as we spent a lot of time talking, arguing, persuading, and learning how to get along. Unfortunately, some fell into the bottle. Many for a short time, some for all of their lives, but most grew into productive lives. What are your memories of those days?
Well, I remember it was a big party. We used to have a lot of fun, but I never looked at it as, I'm sure you go out on a Sunday night and you'd, you know, start dancing and having fun, but, you know, I never looked at it as something that was out of control with me or that could get out of control with me. And I saw people who were obviously on a downward path. I mean, you knew that they were going to be in big trouble unless they changed their lives radically. And unfortunately, a lot of them were not able to. And I think those are the people who aren't with us today. But I'll tell you, I spent a lot of party time with people from the neighborhood who moved on to do the most amazing things.
Both
in terms of their lives and their careers. So it's the age you were at. I mean, I guess it's like, you know, going away to college for the first time. You know, you kind of, you know, you're over 18 now and you're free and you can do whatever you want. But so, you know, most people had enough sense to realize that, well, yeah, you can play, but you also have to get on with your life and do something.
For me, sitting in the park or in the Broadstone or the Willow Tree or Ballarama or Chambers, it was hanging around talking, and the alcohol was like the cement there that kind of kept us there, but it was never the end all, I didn't think, you know, in our lives. It was just growing up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood that came out of the pub culture in Ireland. It was just something that you did.
Well, I remember some of the best conversations I've had during sitting up in the park, just sitting on the steps or sitting on a bench, just not even, you know, with no drink at all, just talking.
Yeah.
Or standing outside of a bar everybody else was in and just chatting away with somebody that you had a lot in common with, and you realized you had a lot in common with. I don't know that the alcohol was that much of a glue for me. It was something that, I guess, pulled people to a certain place and put them there so that they could pursue their relationships.
One of the memories I have of you is us being in the same various places and something crazy going on, then our eyes just catching and saying, boy, is this crazy.
Yeah. Yep.
What did you do after your grad school?
After grad school, I went straight to work. I worked for an engineering company for a short while, and then I went to work for the Department of Environmental Protection, New York City. And I worked for the Department of Health. And I worked at Columbia for some time, and At the moment, I'm at the College of Staten Island. I'm the Director of Environmental Health and Safety down there.
What led you to move to Ireland, and for how long were you there?
Well, I was over in Ireland on a trip, and I met my husband while I was there, and who was not my husband at the time, obviously. And he came over here, and we spent some time together. We decided that we wanted to move back to Ireland, so we did. We moved there, and we were married over there. And then decided that as much as I love it, life here was a lot easier for me in terms of getting work. And I noticed when I was there that women were probably in a position where we were in this country 20 years earlier, you know, in terms of needing. I'll give you an example. I went for a registration for a car, and I was asked if I was married, and I said yes. And he said, well, we'll have to have your husband come in and sign this for you. I went mad. The guy finally said, okay, he was backing up at that point, backing away from me. And so finally said, all right, well, I guess we can pass that over. But that was the situation not that long ago in Ireland for women. So that kind of really made me appreciate what we have here. And I was terribly homesick. Didn't think I would be, but I really was.
Can you also get in for the first time, though, into money-making photography over there?
Not for the first time, no. I had done some editorial work and some portraiture before I went over there. I went over there, and I did some work with a community photography group, basically documenting the situation. We were living in Belfast, so there were plenty of things to take pictures of. So documenting what was going on. And I put together a group of women who had been hired as interns through their job programs over there. And whenever something was interesting was going on, you know, the men all went out to do the photography and the women had to stay back and make the tea. So they were really pretty annoyed about that. So I put together a group of people, a group of women, and taught them photography, took them out, gave them opportunity to go out and shoot. So that was really kind of liberating for them, I think. You know, gave them the sense that they too could do it and do it well.
Did you? You were there during when it was still bad feeling in Northern Ireland. Did you wind up taking any pictures that put you in the same kind of place that your uncle had been during the war?
Yes, I did. I did. I mean, I was stopped several times by the RUC, you know, wanting to see my documentation and who was I and what was I doing there. And fortunately, I'm a member of the American Society of Media Photographers, and we have press passes. And so I was able to sort of wave that in front of his nose, and that kind of calmed things down. But it was a little scary. It was. I mean, it's you know, what people were living through in those days was, you know, and still are in some cases.
I noticed
a little harrowing.
Yeah, it would have to be. I noticed from your list of shows that you had a show in Kerry in 1999 after you had come back to the United States. Did you go over there just for the show? How did that work?
Well, actually, I had been over there. I was in Dingle. And I realized that, I don't know if you knew her or not, a woman from Julie Hanley from England.
Oh, Julie, sure. Sure.
Yeah. Well, I realized that Julie was living over there. She and her husband had moved over, and she had opened a shop. So I was staying in a guest house, and I asked I asked the woman of the house if she knew where I could find Julie, and she told me. And the next thing I know, I got a phone call. It's the sort of place that, you know, the word goes around. There's somebody from New York who knows Julie. So I stayed with Julie, and Julie had a great little shop with a gallery. So she asked me, I had done a lot of shooting over there, so she had asked me to put some things together and, you know, and have a show. So that's what I did. When I came home, I got everything together and sent it over to her. So that was fun.
Last time I spoke to Julie was in 1984, before the reunion that we had here at my lake. And she was all interested in coming. And then she asked if next boyfriend of hers was going to be here. And I said yes. And she decided it wouldn't be appropriate for her to come. And that was the last that I heard of her.
I'll have to ask you offline who that was. She's great.
I know.
I hadn't seen her in years. Hadn't seen her in years.
Do you keep in touch now?
You know, I don't. We did for a while, but I lost track of her. And then actually, it's funny you mention it, because I was looking online to see where the shop was, thinking I could. I lost the phone number, of course, and I think she may have given the shop up, so I wouldn't know where to start at this point. You know, looking for her. I asked a couple of people if they had heard from her, and they said no. So I don't know if she's still in Ireland or if they decided to come back. I would say they're probably still in Ireland because they had sort of settled in nicely there.
Kathy mentioned her her marriage. After she was back working for the city, and I had been going back to Wall Street, we got together for lunch, and Kathy gave me her card, and I said, I noticed that you're still using your maiden name. And she said, no, that's my married name. I married the person named Collins, so her name is Kathy Collins Collins.
That's right. Don't have to change the initials on the towels. It's very nice.
You and Eleanor Roosevelt Roosevelt. That was her name,
That's right.
I know that since you've been back, you've alternated between working in your academic field and concentrating primarily on your photography. The prologue to your 2010 book, Bicoastal, Atlantic to Pacific and Beyond, and I quote it, the images in this book are published in the hope that they will inspire readers to be stewards of our remarkable planet. These ecosystems are threatened by climate change and human encroachment and cannot be restored once lost. That seems to tie the two together. Could you expand on this relationship?
Well, I think given that I do a lot of photography, and given that I have the interest in the science and the biology, it just sort of normally fit in together. That I would be reading about or studying something and then decide, let me see if I can go out and sort of document this or find examples of it for photography. And, you know, when you study ecology, I mean, it's how things are all linked together. And for me, my photography is linked with my knowledge and interest in sciences.
Speaking of your photography, you've had a number of photographic shows and have won awards for your work, both in the U.S. and Ireland. Would you tell us about them?
I've been in a lot of shows, a lot of group shows, and I've had some one-person shows as well at the Irish Arts Center here in New York and a few other places. I've been in a lot of group shows. Probably more than it's on the list that I've shown you. And I was able to, I'm a co-founder and chair also of the American Society of Media Photographers Fine Arts Specialty Group. ASMP is a nationwide organization. It's been around since the 40s, started by several photographers who realized that they needed to band together and share information. They were primarily publication photographers at that point. But things have changed in photography so much over the years that it now really includes many, many kinds of media, as well as videographers who combine their work with photography. So we set up, there are several specialty groups, architectural, food photography, and a friend and I set up the fine art specialty group for people who are interested in fine art, people in the organization who are interested in fine art and want to know more about it, how, you know, I'm working on it, how can I get it out there, what do galleries say about it. So it's been a lot of fun doing that. That's, I've been doing that for, gosh, 10 years now.
I noticed that you also seem to be very involved with the Brooklyn Waterfront Artists Coalition. What is that?
It's a group of artists who from South Brooklyn who had gotten together some time ago. I've been part of that group since 99, I guess, about 13 or 14 years now. People who are photographers, painters, sculptors. We have a gallery that was given to us free of charge in an old Civil War warehouse in Red Hook, right on the water. And we have three major shows a year. What it is, it's allowing people to show their work who normally wouldn't have the entree into the gallery world. And it's been very, very successful because we've attracted a lot of gallerists who come over to see the work and who, people have gone on to better things. But it's a very free-flowing, it's mostly a non-juried group, so we anticipate that the artist is going to jury their own work. And decide what is good to show. We do have some juried competitions in there. We have people from MoMA and from various museums coming to jury. So it's grown, and it's a wonderful group of artists and people to work with.
Now, you've also exhibited at MoMA, haven't you, their online project?
Their online project, yeah, that was, that was a while ago. Yeah, that was a juried online competition, and I was honored to be selected.
You've also had an ongoing relationship with St. Francis College, haven't you?
Yeah, they have a nice little gallery in the front of the school, which is in Brooklyn Heights, and a group of us from BWAC actually have shown there four or five times. I guess they ask us to come back and, you know, in various themed shows. So that's a place that we've been showing quite a bit.
And what is the Alice Austin House Museum? I noticed you've been there, too.
Right. That's in Staten Island. It's up, it's somewhat near Snug Harbor, up around St. George, and Alice Austin lived in this house years ago, and she left it to, as a museum. She dedicated it as a museum, and it's a wonderful place. It's an actual home, and beautiful, beautiful place and great venue to show artwork. You know, not big, huge pieces, but just nicely framed pieces on the wall. You can go from room to room and appreciate the work. And she has some beautiful grounds, so if it's nice when we do it in the nice weather. So you can invite your friends and have cocktails on the lawn and then go and see some of the artwork. So that's been fun too.
While you were working at Columbia, you also placed first in a Columbia University faculty show. Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah, it was first in photography. They had various media. They had, you know, painting and sculpture and photography. And I wasn't sure if I was going to do it or not, but the friend of mine who was curating the thing talked me into it. And, you know, I brought one picture over, and it happened. I just kind of took it off the wall and hung it up there, and won first prize, which was great. I mean, I was very, very pleased and flattered that happened.
Which picture was that, Kathy?
It's a hand colored black and white of the 42nd Street subway by Fifth Avenue. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's right by Bryant Park.
Okay.
And it was taken the day after one of those storms that one gets in the fall that knocks all the leaves off the trees.
Okay.
So the trees are bare, but the leaves on the ground are probably up to your knees. You know, just the entire sidewalk was covered. Absolutely covered with these things. And I had this in another show, and I overheard two people talking to him, and they said, "That can't be real. She must have set that up." I said, "Yeah, I brought in a dump truck full of leaves to take a picture."
She blew all the leaves off the tree.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, it was nice that it was recognized.
How did you happen to get involved with the Manhattan Borough President's Office? I noticed that was a show, too.
Yeah, that was a good question. Who curated that? I think that was the Sierra Club.
Yeah, I noticed that you have a
Sierra
couple
Club
of...
The Sierra Club has a photography group.
With them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
so,
and you've exhibited there before with the Sierra Club, right?
Yes, we've shown in a couple of places, actually. Calumet Photography, which unfortunately just closed, has a beautiful gallery area. And so they have been doing annual Sierra Club shows there, which are really, that's a great group. I mean, it's sort of everybody's of the same mind in the Sierra Club, so... you know, it's they're great. They have outings that you can go to, you know, cleanups around the New York area, and interest groups.
What about the Audubon Center in Greenwich? How did you get involved there?
You know, I'm not sure how I got there. Somebody had asked me to submit some work, I think, to them, and for the life of me, I can't remember who it was. The Audubon Center. It might have been part of Sierra Club. I don't really know. I don't know how I got there, but there I was.
Then one of the fairly recent things, too, you also burned the show at Javits. What was that?
Right. That's a contemporary art fair that's done annually. That was enough said about that. It was a bit of a circus. You know, too many people, too many different kinds of things. It was way too general for what I do.
Okay.
You know, plus somebody stole my cell phone, so... I came away from that with a with a nasty taste in my mouth. But it was an experience. I decided to do it just to see what it would be like, and I found out what it's like to do something like that, and I don't want to do it again.
You mentioned last week when we talked on the phone that you were presently submitting to something out west too. What's that?
Oh, New Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot I told you about that. Yeah. I got an email, people requesting, they're having a show in Albuquerque. I think it's in June. And they had asked for submissions of work that was New Mexico photos. And actually, I was down in New Mexico a couple of years ago, and I did some shooting down there. And so I sent a few pieces off. So I don't know. I mean, I just sent them last week. So we'll see. It'd be fun if they were chosen. I mean, it's a jury show. So if they choose one of my pictures, that'd be fun. Give me an excuse to go back.
Were you in New Mexico to take pictures, or were you there for some other reason?
No, I was there. Actually, my husband had some gigs down there. My husband's a musician.
Right, okay.
So we decided, you know, I decided to go with him. It was just before I started working at Staten Island. So we went down there, and I was able to do some photography. It was kind of busy, so fortunately I didn't get around as much as I wanted to. You know, I did some shooting, mostly up around Santa Fe. So that's kind of what I put in. So we'll see. We'll see if that happens. It'd be fun.
Many of us, including me, may not understand what a person with an environmental science background does. Other than your 4 years at Stone & Webster with the title Principal Scientist, your employment in your academic field has been with public institutions, two colleges, mm-hmm. Columbia, and a college
right.
of Staten Island, and two students with the City of New York. Tell us something about what you did in these positions, what you do.
Well, let's see. I guess if I had to, you know, generalize with it, I do regulatory compliance to make sure that where I'm working is meeting all regulations, environmental regulations. I have done some environmental planning, which is kind of more up my alley, if you will, because you can see, for example, if the city wants to place something in a given area, I would have to go and see if it was appropriate to put it there, what the environmental challenges might be, and if they would have to do any mitigation before they placed it. Unfortunately, a lot of it isn't as hands-on as I would like. I mean, I love field work. I like to be out there with my nose in the dirt, if you will, but you know, working in New York City, you don't have too many options for that. So, yeah, I've been doing, you know, and just basically making sure that environmental issues are addressed through various projects that are going on. And I do a lot of, over the past few years, I've been doing a lot of health and safety issues as well. Doing safety training and making sure that people are working with toxic materials, that they're handling them properly and disposing of them correctly. It's a broad field. Excuse me. It's a pretty broad field, and you know, I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it.
Back to photography. Tell us a little more about your book.
Well, it's a book that is a self-published book. I put it together, and with encouragement from you, he said, "Why don't you put some of this stuff together?" So I said, "Yeah, why not? Why not?" So, so I got some pictures that are primarily East Coast, West Coast, and Puerto Rico. It's almost like a travel book. And some of the pictures that I like the best, that I think are most representative of those areas, of the environment in those areas. Pardon me. And It was fun putting it together because it's, you know, you've got to go through all your stuff and see, sure, does this work or does that work? But it's great, and it also works very well. If people want an example of my work, for example, and they don't have immediate access to a computer to go to my website, or they want to see what something looks like in print, I can just pull this out and show it to them.
You also did a good job of explaining it to people at the book fair that we had at Coogan's, where you had previously exhibited some of your work,
mm-hmm.
I remember. How can the audience obtain the book and see some of your photos and keep in touch with your upcoming events?
Well, everything's on my website. It's www.kcollinsphotography.com.
Okay.
I have events on there. I have to bring it up to date, as a matter of fact. I've been ignoring it for a while. But there's a large number of images on there that people can look at. They can see a preview of the book and learn how to order it. Or if somebody wants to email me, I could. I have some copies that I can send off to them. And if I, as I have shows and events coming up, I list them on the website. So I find that's the easiest way for me at the moment.
We have a caller on the line, but I'll get to the caller in a moment or two. I have another question on a photography, and then later we'll get back to the things. It seems to me that you have uniquely melded science and art, fields that many, incorrectly, in my judgment, see as incompatible. Do you see that as your calling to marry these two things?
I don't know if it's a calling. It's something that is just came very naturally to me because of the subjects that I work with. I don't think it's incompatible at all. I mean, I know any number of scientists who are also artists. It's sort of left brain, right brain coming together. And I was amazed, actually, when I was in the show at Columbia, how many physicians and surgeons had their work up, you know, and beautiful work. So, you know, in response to your question about being incompatible, it's definitely not. I think it's a creativity that's reflected in various disciplines that come together.
I'd agree, particularly in the writing of some scientists, like Richard Feynman's writing on "I'm Seriously, You're Joking, Mr. Feynman," and things like that.
Yeah.
That was very creative. Let me pick the caller up, and then I'll come back with some other questions.
Sure.
A caller, you're on the line. Who are you? Hello?
Hello?
John? Yes, Jim Taylor.
Yeah, I didn't call to raise a question. The reason I called was... the transmission keeps getting interrupted, and so I read on the email that you can call in to listen.
Okay, so you're just listening. You don't even know Kathy.
I'm listening with very interest because I've worked in the environmental field myself, but from the standpoint of economics, I've done environmental impact studies. I was on the environmental committee of the Inter-American Development Bank, but. Yeah. Your guest, Kathleen Collins, obviously approaches the subject matter from a much different perspective. Since I'm on the line, I might ask her, you Dr. Collins?
No,
hello?
No, just Masters.
Okay. What should I call you then?
Kathy.
Okay. Kathleen or Kathy. I'm Jim. I grew up on Sherman Avenue between 204th and Academy Street.
Yeah.
What do you see your mission as an environmentalist? Simply providing scientific information for people so they can make decisions, or do you have a different mission or goal?
Well, that's kind of a broad question. Well, I would say yes. Providing that information is absolutely key to regulators and to politicians who are making decisions. Some of them choose to ignore it, or say it's incorrect. But, yeah, I think that that's where my expertise is in allowing people, giving them the information and telling them how they should use it. You know, whether people choose to do that or not, you know, in this world it's a very, very strange stuff going on. I have a strong streak of activism as well, so I was just telling someone a while ago that when I retire from my current position, God willing, what I would love to do is be out in the Sea Shepherd for a while.
Yeah, where?
In the Sea Shepherd, you know, the anti-whaling boat that the Sierra Club runs.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you have ever done advocacy work, or there are any particular causes you espouse, or ways in which you like to change people's values toward the environment.
Well, I think I don't have too much of an option. I mean, I belong to environmental groups, and I support their mission, and I attend as many events as I can and sign as many petitions, but I'm not really in a position at the moment where I can go out and be waving signs. But advocacy, yes, certainly. I advocate for a number of things within the format of groups that I belong to.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, as a background, Jim is a when he lived in England, fought in the Golden Gloves, but he's also a PhD in agricultural economics from the University of Wisconsin. Yeah. And he spent time through Latin America, as he mentioned, working for the Development Bank.
Then he's
been a guest on the show. He also lives in the Washington area, where he's run across Richie Shinnick and some other folks. I'm going to hold him on the line while I talk about beginning to Inwood. He may have something to add.
Jim, I'd also like, I want to go back to the archives and listen to your interview with John. It sounds very, very interesting what you've done.
Yeah, I don't think we talked very much about the environment, but I kind of slipped into environmental economics, and I kind of run into a lot of things by accident and then develop an interest. I was on the Governor's Committee for Environmental Quality in New Mexico. But anyway, go ahead, John, and I'll listen. If I have any further questions, I'll jump in.
Great.
Jim is also a historian of Inwood and the Revolutionary time and of New York. He's given talks both on the island and to New York Historic Society, and he led a expedition that we had up through Inwood Park with Ed Winnie and Barbara McMullen and Roberta McHale and Larry Leaf and Tom Cahill to try to find a Fort Cock Hill that was the Revolutionary fort up in the park that we think we know where it is, but we never really got it. So
I'm sorry I missed it. I would have liked to have come along on that.
Yeah. So let's get back to the craziness of Inwood. It seemed that every time I interviewed someone from our time in the neighborhood, the passion with which we pursued life in those days carried over into the passion which we have pursued our chosen field and our later lives. Have you thought about that at all? How your background affected you, your drive or anything?
Well, yes, in a way. I don't want this to sound negative, and I don't mean it negatively, but we were talking before about the bar culture and seeing people who we cared for and grew up with sort of heading down a slippery slope of drinking and losing their jobs and all of the above. And the one thing I realized very early on observing this is that this is not for me. I need to get out of this. I need to get away from it. I need to get out in the fresh air. And I was able to do that. I mean, it was a passion of mine to learn more about life than what I was seeing in Inwood. As wonderful as things were in Inwood, as wonderful as thrilled as I am to have grown up there. And I'll never forget it. It's always home. I needed to get away from it in order to pursue what I wanted to pursue. Do you know what I mean?
I understand, and I understand to most that the worst thing that most people did who got married young and was they stayed in the neighborhood and they were in the same blah habits that they were before they got married. That the more successful marriages were people who moved away from the neighborhood.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And
Go ahead.
No, go on, John.
I do think it's gratifying that whenever we gather, be it our monthly luncheon, benefits, and reunions, that we come together with people we haven't seen in years, even perhaps weren't close to growing up, without any pretension or posturing. There's no where I now stand in the economic chain. There's just good cheer and interest in other people's lives. Now, I know that when we had the reunion here in 1984, that you were quoted saying that the disturbing thing was the majority of the people seem to be living in the past, talking about their growing up time rather than, you know, their interest in religion or science or sports or whatever. Do you still feel that way, or do you think that there's a mature relationship with the...
No, I certainly don't remember saying that. You know, I guess I did, if you remember it, but...
But do a quote of it.
Yeah. I think we're of an age now where we tend to look back on things, you know, with more rose-colored glasses. And also, you know, we know the value of our upbringing and the value of our experiences growing up. And that sort of, it's comforting in a way. I mean, at this point, I think that's what people sort of want to talk about, you know, at a reunion sort of thing. You know, it's a reunion. You know, oh, you remember this, you remember that, you know. I mean, if you have side conversations about what your accomplishments have been in life, that's great. But, you know, it's mostly, you know, you're getting together and you're 65 years old and you've known these people since you were 10, you know, and you can talk about, quite comfortably talk about what it was like then and what you used to do and have a good laugh about it.
The thing that I've been impressed with is the way people have kind of reached out, like when, at the benefit in honor of, or in memory of Tom Hanlon Jr. or at Crow Park for Frankie Grillo's granddaughter or for Rory Finn, or the way people have come together. There was the fairly recent thing that a fellow who had grown up across from the church died up in Albany. He was known as a person who knew a lot about Irish literature, a fellow named Peter Dolan. But he was alone. And
I didn't know he died.
And Richie Scalata and a bunch of the people from the neighborhood and from the surrounding neighborhood that went to Manhattan Prep and to Manhattan College, they arranged for his body to be cremated, be brought down to Good Shepherd for a funeral, and to be buried in the cemetery by the Springbrook Parkway. And then just the fact that people, after all these years, hang together for things like that, I think is remarkable.
Well, the one thing that I think is unique about Inwood and Inwood people is how we are such and have continued to be such a tight community, caring about each other. I mean, what you just cited to me, I mean, I've known similar situations with other people from the neighborhood over the years where someone had drifted away and... you know, were kind of out there lost, and other people from the neighborhood went and sought them out.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I miss, I think, in my life so much is that kind of community.
Jim,
you know,
do you
don't find that very often, if at
Jim,
all.
Jim, do you want to jump in here you've lived all over the country and in Latin America. What's your feelings on this?
My feeling on what, John?
On is there anything unique about the bonding of the people from Inwood, or have you found that in other places that you've lived? And
no, I have not found it in other places. I belong to a New York Memories group at the local senior center. And there are people from different parts of the city and surrounding areas, Long Island, New Jersey. And I don't think any of them have the sort of interest in their own neighborhood and have maintained contacts the way the Inwood people have. It's also interesting that, for example, there's a website called the Inwood Board. I don't know if you looked at it, John, or Kathy is aware of it. But no, pardon me, it's a Manhattan board. It's for people from all over Manhattan. Well, it became completely dominated by people from Inwood. To the extent that people from other neighborhoods started complaining about how the Inwoodites dominated things.
Well, we were always like that, weren't we?
I guess so, yeah.
Well,
so I think there's something unique about the neighborhood. I think Richie Shinnick described it as a kind of a village, but at the same time, we had, I guess, the excitement and the advantage of growing up in a great metropolis, which is New York. So we had both things. We had the advantage of being in New York, and we had our own neighborhood with its boundaries and its particular ways. And
we were always glad to get back to it.
Yeah.
You know, if you went downtown for something,
yeah.
You know, there was something that made you feel so warm and fuzzy about just getting back uptown.
Sure.
You know, dropping off to see your friends, you know, it was great.
It was
amazing.
Bobby Dunne, the younger brother of the one on Chickie Dunne, had posted years ago on the Inwood mailing list that we always got in trouble when we went out of our neighborhood. And in this new 50-minute radio show that I have, I've described both a beer rack at Pace College, where it came back to haunt me years later when someone recognized me when I had this new position with the federal government that was supposed to be very highly selective, and it was four of us chosen from hundreds of people. And one of the other fellows said, I know you. The other fellow took the swing at the dean of my college. That was also the night that Jim Connors got run over by the subway train. And so that was one of the stories that I put up on my new 15-minute radio show. The last one was a racket over in the Bronx where we had some problems, and the night ended with Terry Shagrew pushing Bill McLaughlin into the window of Al Connors, which broke, and then pulling him out. No, you all left. We did get in some strange circumstances when we left the neighborhood, I think.
That teaches a lesson.
John, if I can comment, one of my Inwood memories, it's not the best memory, is that there are people that got into trouble by coming into Inwood in the Bronx or Washington Heights if they belong to rival gangs. I've seen and actually once participated in some rather nasty encounters. But I want to say something else. There may even be an Inwood way of speaking. This may sound strange, but I'll cite something from my own experience. I worked at the Inter-American Development Bank, where most of the employees were from Latin America. At a retirees function, I said hello to a Bolivian friend of mine. He was talking to an American, and he introduced me to the American. I can't think of his name. I didn't know him as an active employee, but I met him. He started talking. He said to him, "Where are you from?" Except from New York City. Where in New York? Manhattan. About where in Manhattan? Far uptown Manhattan. Exactly where? I said, well, I grew up in the Broad Dyke apartments. Those are the apartments at the intersection of Broadway and Dyckman Street. There was something about the way he spoke. Accent, intonation, whatever. You know, it made me think that this guy is from the area I grew up. I wasn't even consciously thinking. I was just like a dog following a scent.
That's funny.
Jim mentioned the Manhattan Board. That was how he found out that Gene Coghlan had passed away in Florida.
It was up
on the Manhattan Board.
I haven't been on there in some time. I should go on again.
It's not very active. Unfortunately, sometimes these nostalgia boards deteriorate over time. I'm not saying this in reference to the Inwood site, but for example, John Donnelly. I don't know if John knows who John Donnelly is. John Donnelly grew up on Academy Street.
It's not the John Donnelly who lived in Kathy's house, who's a retired Air Force colonel. It's
right,
another one.
Right.
Okay. John Donnelly posts some nostalgic things, and some people have just gotten into politics and gotten very nasty. I think part of the problem is that you can recycle nostalgia for just so long, and then people start looking for other things, or people want to start trouble, so they simply do it.
I think you find that in practically every listserv group. I have that even in the fine art group. There's always somebody who wants to come on and start not a debate, but an argument about something. You know, here's what I think. What do you think? It's very strange. Yeah, I know what you mean, though, about sort of listservs sort of winding down when they're based on a nostalgic
The reason they're cutting the funding for the arts is that Paul Ryan has no soul, or the reason that we don't have more in New York is de Blasio's more interested in something else. Oh, yeah, people all of a sudden just throw out stuff like that.
I know. Well, John, I must say you've been very good at keeping the peace on the Inwood board.
Yeah.
To the point that people are afraid to say anything.
Can I ask Kathy a question, John?
Sure.
Yeah, Kathy, are there any aspects of the Inwood sort of physical and natural environment that you find particularly interesting?
Well, the park, obviously. I mean, that is a – you can make a career out of studying that park because it's the only natural forest land left in Manhattan. And I mean, I don't know that we appreciated it for what it is when we lived up there. It was just some place to go up and walk through and on your way to the cloisters or something. But it's an amazing natural environment, and I just hope that they keep it that way, that nobody does anything to it.
It's interesting that you say that about how we didn't appreciate the Indian caves and the history and the tulip tree and all that. Jim Casey, who you know, is very involved now in stained glass windows, and he has a book on it. He's been to France to study it. It all relates to physics, to the stained glass windows that were in the Barrytown House of Formation when he was there for the Christian Brothers, and is now owned by the Moonies. But he said that it was only when he was up there at a reunion of ex-brothers that he said that he looked at the windows that he had seen every day for 4 years, and he finally saw them.
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, especially when you move to someplace different and you don't have that kind of environment around you, then you say to yourself, I mean, we're very lucky here. I live in Brooklyn, and we're not far from Prospect Park, which is much more landscaped. I mean, it's not a natural occurrence. It was built as a park. But there are parts of it that are sort of tucked away where I get the Inwood Hill feeling about it, that nobody goes up there very much, or it's, So I rather miss that. I also miss the the Gaelic football games down the lower field, you know. But it's fun now, you know, you go up there and you see all the Dominicans playing baseball.
Speaking of the park and the atmosphere, I was talking to Mickey Connolly at the benefit for Tommy Hanlon's son, and he said that he and Betty come over to Inwood Park sometimes to feed the squirrels. And I said, they don't have squirrels in Woodlawn? He said, yeah, but it's not the same.
They're not the same squirrels. Well, Betty and Mickey hung on for the longest of mostly everyone. I mean, they moved out not too long ago. I mean, they were the real holdouts in Inwood. Most of us had gone well before. So,
the fellow from your old house has what I think is the nicest apartment in Inwood. Pierce Wilkinson and his wife Pat Ridge have the corner apartment in that building on the top floor, the one Hobart used to have over the park.
Oh, sweet. Very nice.
So they're there. Now, Mary Connolly's still in the building also.
Mary and Pat's still there.
Excuse me, Kathy, did you say that geology is one of your interests?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then do you remember the White Rocks?
Sure. Down by on Nagel. 10th
yeah.
Avenue? Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah. We used to play on those all the time.
One of the things I was surprised to learn is that marble throughout the greater New York area is called Inwood marble.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that out in a course I took at the U.S. Department of Agriculture Graduate School in Washington, D.C. It was taught by an urban geologist. And the subject matter of the course was how Washington, D.C. was influenced, or how the urban development of Washington, D.C. was influenced by its natural setting, particularly the Potomac River.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't taking it for credit, but I did a paper on the transformation of Spuytendyvil Creek into the Harlem River ship canal.
Right.
And I mentioned, and I covered the fact that when they built the canal, they severed, as so many people know, Marble Hill from the rest of Manhattan Island.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who was teaching the course said, yeah, he said, I know about Inwood marble. And I'd never heard of Inwood marble. And I think that's what the White Rocks are made of.
That's right.
There's an outcropping at the corner of Isham Street. And
by Good Shepherd. Right across from Good Shepherd.
Right. And I think there are several others.
There was one, the street that I grew up on, 204th Street,
mm-hmm.
Where St. Jude's School is now.
Uh-huh.
That was an outcropping as well.
Okay.
We used to play cowboys and Indians there. It was wonderful growing up.
Yeah.
Girls
and Indians. I don't know if you know where Wild's Bar was located.
Sure.
No.
Do you know where the Inwood Lounge was?
Whose?
The Inwood Lounge.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a few doors north of that was Wild's Bar. It became the Pig and Whistle or something like that.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Behind that and the apartment building next to it, there's also a fairly large outcropping of marble, but I don't think too many people are aware of it because you had to get through an alleyway and over a fence to get to see it. Interestingly, the guy who taught that course, the urban geologist in D.C., told me of three buildings in the district in Washington, D.C., that are made partially or wholly with Inwood marble. So that was quite a discovery.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
The other thing, Jim, is you know about the big fire that took down the corner of 27th Street. Well, they've taken that out, and there's going to be a bank there and other things. But if you look through the fence, the foundation of those buildings is all the White Rock.
No kidding.
That you can see down into the hole. And if you remember, Kathy, you were probably living there then, but when they put up what became Sandra's house that was in between the house at the corner of Indian Road and 215th Street, 214th Street, and the houses up above it, that was the vacant lot. It's called the Foundation. And that foundation was the White Rocks, too. Yeah. But then, yeah, so it must have been all over.
Yeah, it is, but it's, and it's interesting, it's distinctly different from Fordham, from the Bronx. If you just go right across the river there, that's Fordham Gneiss, G-N-E-I-S-S.
Okay.
It's a totally different kind of rock. So it's, I mean, geologically it's an interesting area. And then, of course, we have the Palisades.
Right, right.
Which are amazing.
You're talking about the New Jersey Palisades?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I thought they were natural.
They are.
I mean, they are natural in one sense. But apparently a lot of rock was blown out of the Palisades using dynamite, and then it was used for construction material or something like that.
I remember hearing that, yeah. But, no, I mean, they're a natural structure. It's actually cooled lava, like basaltic lava.
Yeah.
And, you know the... I don't know if you've ever been to Ireland, but in the north of Ireland, there's what they call the Giant's Causeway.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of that on television.
It's the same principle, that when it cools, it turns into these angular, columnar pieces. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Every time I see the Palisades, particularly north of the George Washington Bridge, I thank the Rockefeller family.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
They did a great thing when they bought that. I think they did it for their own selfish purposes, to preserve the view across the river when they owned the property, which is now Fort Tryon Park.
Well, you know, they've also done things that I don't think it was for their own benefit. The island of St. John in the U.S. Virgins. That was all Rockefeller land.
That was Lawrence Rockefeller. Yeah.
Yeah, they ceded it to the U.S. Park Service.
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right. One of the Rockefellers played a big role in the what do you call that area? That national park near Jackson, Wyoming, the Tetons.
In the Grand Teton National Park.
Yeah. And they also were very generous in. Giving away, I think it was their land in, is it Arcadia National Park in Maine, near Bar Harbor, Maine?
Yes, yeah, Arcadia.
They've done wonderful things.
Yeah.
Teddy Roosevelt
lives on.
They were the people behind the cloisters, obviously, but they also eventually, I mentioned Barrytown earlier, where the Christian Brothers had their, had the House of Formation. They originally had their House of Formation, including having those stained glass windows that had been sent from France. They originally had that at what became Pataca Hills. And the Rockefellers wanted that land, and they made the brothers an offer they couldn't refuse. And then they moved all the buildings up to Barrytown. And they took that over.
Yeah. Well, whatever you think of the Rockefellers, they beat today's developers, that's for sure.
I wonder if our discussion of the of the rocks of Inwood is boring the hell out of our audience.
Probably.
I hope not.
Well, you never know what people have these little interests that they don't talk about a lot. Somebody might pick up a local geology text to look it all up.
Do you remember when the geology students from NYU or from City College used to come up, and they used to be analyzing the rocks by Good Shepherd, and we used to really
I did it myself when I was in college.
And we spoiled
their
lectures.
I felt like an idiot.
We spoiled their lectures by standing behind them and saying, gee, they look like rocks to me, you know, and things like that.
Yeah, when I was in college, one of my classes, we had to go up there and, you know, look at the rocks. I'm looking over at the school and saying, I wonder if anybody recognizes me. Like my old eighth grade teacher or something, waving.
We've covered a lot of bases and exploring your interesting and productive life. What else would you like our audience to know about Kathleen Collins?
Oh, goodness.
Goodness had nothing to do with it, as Mother West said.
think, Jess, that I have a lot of interests in my life, and my philosophy of life has been that I do not want to die regretting the fact that I haven't done something that I've wanted to do. So that is how I try and live my life. Either studying something or visiting it or performing it. I've had a good life, and I have to give a lot of credit to that to, you know, my friends from Inwood, and just having grown up there, and just the support that they have given me over the years. I couldn't believe it. I had one person shows I had in the city was down in the East Village, and a whole bunch of people from Inwood came down. And I couldn't believe they were there. I hadn't seen them, and, you know, Eileen Keogh, and, you know, a bunch of people. And they
people
said, we came to support you. I know. We heard you were doing this. Oh, that's great. You're a local girl. We came to support you. And, I mean, that's what Inwood is. You know? I mean, we've aged a lot, but, you know, we still are close to these people and always will be. They're our sisters and brothers.
But you also knew enough to move on and then to return on your own terms.
Exactly.
All right.
Well put.
Jim, do you have anything to add before we call it a night?
Well, in terms of those guys that were looking at the rocks in Inwood, it reminded me of the fact that I had to take geology in college as an agriculture major, and I absolutely hated it.
Oh.
I hated it with a passion. Just managed to pass. But everything changed when I went to live in Nicaragua, because I experienced earthquake tremors and volcanoes returning to activity, and I wanted to know how these things happen and why. And then I became fascinated with geology. So
the same with me with physics. I hated it, but now I can't get enough of it.
I feel the same way. The two things that I wish that I had better teachers in high school and in college and gotten more deeply into then, well, physics and economics. I had very boring economics course about land, labor, and capital.
I know.
And put me to sleep. And there's so much there, and there's so much good physics there, you know?
The teachers make such a difference. I mean, people have asked me, well, why don't you teach, you know? And I don't think I'm a teacher. There are some people who are, you know, those who can teach should teach. Because you have to transmit not only technical information, but also a passion for your subject. And I could count on two fingers of one hand the teachers that I've ever had who had passion for their subject.
But you have
You know that would be a big advantage if you went into teaching.
And you've got passion, Kathy.
For certain subjects I do, and I, you know, you're right. I probably could. I mean, I've taught photography,
right?
Because A, I know the subject, and B, I enjoy the subject, and I enjoy passing that on to other people. But I mean, you know, teaching young ones, you know, on the way up, or you know, freshmen in college who have no idea what they're doing there, you know, you really need to.
I'm doing that, and I'm enjoying it. That reminds me, though, we didn't get to some technology about photography. Have you embraced digital photography, or are you?
Totally. I got rid of my darkroom about 5-6 years ago, finally.
Okay.
And I've never looked back. I waited until the digital technology was as good as or better than film photography. And it's a joy. It's kind of expensive,
you telling me,
but it's
I remember you telling me years ago when we were first getting into it that it was fine for the occasional photographer, but at the high end, that they hadn't yet perfected the resolution or the quality. And I guess they have now, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, they've gone beyond. It's okay. I mean, some of the higher-end cameras are remarkable, absolutely remarkable what they can do. So I don't – the only people I know who are still doing film photography are those who are doing alternative process.
Okay.
You know, who are making negatives and then doing something else with them.
You mentioned earlier of photography place that was also the gallery. Do you remember, do you know if Modern Age still exists? They were my...
Yeah, they're still there. I haven't used them in quite a while, but they are still there.
The one by St. Paul's, the one by St. Paul's Chapel, they have two of them. They had an uptown one.
No, I don't think they have the downtown one anymore. I think they're up on 6th Avenue, 40-something Street. They're still there,
All right, well...
Thank you so much for this opportunity to chat.
And thanks for calling in, Jim.
Okay,
yeah,
John, enjoyed it.
Jim, nice talking to you.
Likewise.
Maybe
we'll cross paths up and in with someday. Do you ever go to the lunches at the McSherry's?
I haven't been in quite a while because, I mean, working in Staten Island, it's a bit of a schlep on my lunch hour.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, hopefully, you know, my day job will go the way of all day jobs in the not too distant future, so that I can focus on my photography and my artwork and seeing people who I haven't seen in a long time for lunch.
Don't say that, Kathy. They may be listening in.
That's all right. I keep threatening. They know.
Okay. In the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if a Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with Michelle Somerville. And until then, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya.
See ya.
Good night.
Good night.
Steady, Silver. Steady.